Maybe a little bit of light. Upright the lights. Oh, the Andes, the Camerons, are not here.
No, they're run. Okay, can I start? What would be the problem with just saying the definition of the conventional truth, and this also is sort of the definition of ultimate truth, if you just said the definition of the conventional truth is an object that is found by a valid compromise, it's found by a conventionality. Okay.
Leaving Buddhas aside,
yes.
Then that is perfect for ordinary beings, but for sentient beings. Just to include the Buddha's mind. It's exactly, if we're just talking about, sentient beings, then the first part of the definition is enough.
So then he said that the first part of the definition eliminates the non-existence could be a definition. And the second part of the definition eliminates the infinite could be a definition. Maybe there's a little bit more to it than just to deal with the Buddhist perception. Because that second part, so I suppose the only person who could compromise the conventionalities and influence is a Buddha, Again, makes that second part of the Dhamma.
For ordinary persons. So there would be no mistake, because just the first part specifically says conventional object. With regard to eliminating non-existence as conventional truths, did he say that somebody asserts that non-existence are conventional truths? Oh yeah. He said that the Patanjalikas assert both real and unreal conventional truths. So that must be I can't remember that coming up, but that must be a Svatantrika assertion. The conventional truths are divided into real ones and unreal ones, a rabbit's horn. Have you got the spat intrigues here?
Yeah.
What do they say about convention?
Not in here, they really didn't talk about
no.
The two truths at all. I think it's true without
them. Uh huh. Oh, really?
Yeah,
it should be. Oh, it's a little bit.
Ultimate truth, final reality, subtle stories.
I'm pretty sure. Well, it's difficult with his pronunciation. All right, so that's settled. I thought to read out an exchange between Geshe Trungpa Techok and the students at Nalanda. With regard to the merely labelling and basis of imputation, but actually I hinted at it in the meditation this morning. But this is the transcript, and there's the exchange of question and answer has been recorded. So a student asks, when you say the other schools find the person, right, so all the schools other than Prasangikas, on analysing the aggregates, they claim to find the person. You know, an illustration of the person. The Spatantrikas say it's mental consciousness. Chittamatrans say it's the mind basis of all. Sotantrikas say it's the collection of aggregates. And the Vibhasika say it's the continuity of the aggregates. But they find that as an illustration of the person. The Prasangikas say, if you examine the basis of imputation of person, there is nothing to findable to be the person. So the question comes, when you say the other schools find the person, do they find a substantial person? And Geshe Techok says they find a self which exists from its own side. The Svatantrikas say that first there is the quality of existence from its own side, and then the imputation person is made from the side of the subject. The Prasangikas say nothing exists from its own side, not a single atom. All is merely labelled by mind. So whatever exists, exists as a mere label by mind or a mere imputation by mind. That's how phenomena exist. Of course, the imputation upon a basis of imputation. So, the student asks, if the mere I is just a conceptual imputation, how can it create karma and go from life to life? Reasonable question. It might have been me, I think. Geshe said, firstly, the mere I is imputed, but it's not just a conception. It simply exists as a mere name or label. That's how we exist, simply as a mere name or label. Student says, it seems that the cause of the label, the imputation, must be the mind, even though you say the mere I is neither mind nor form. Geshe says, the mere name does have a cause, and we can say it is the conceptual consciousness. The student says, well then, how can the mere I be neither form nor mind? That's what, in the classification of phenomena, there are impermanent phenomena, then they're either material or form, mental, one of the different aspects of mind, or they're impermanent and they're neither mind nor form. And person is an example in that collection of things. So Geshe says, no problem. A cause does not necessarily have to be the same type as its result. So the question is, like, if the mere I is a result of conceptual imputation, then as conception is mind, the mere I must be mind, because the cause has to be the same as the result. But Geshe says that that's not necessary. The student replies, but something merely imputed by mind must be nature of mind, because its basis is merely imputed by mind, and the basis of that merely imputed by mind, and so on. So Geshe replies, everything is a mere imputation by conception, so what? So we haven't come to the subjects yet, but that's probably this afternoon or next time, but it's good to think about, and it gets quite subtle.
To separate, and I'm sort of thinking of myself, Alan, to separate that as the mere label versus this inherent view of Alan,
The mere Alan is not separate from the inherently existing one. Well, the inherent existent Alan doesn't exist at all. The appearance exists. So the term mere, it negates any existence from the side of the object of imputation. So that the wrong appearance is when we think of ourself or another person, there's the appearance of the basis of imputation. This is important. The aggregates, the body and mind, they appear first, and they appear to be inherently existing. Then the imputation comes. So our mistake is that we impute I or Alan or Gyatso onto the falsely appearing, inherently existing person. Right? And we believe it, the mere I, to truly exist, because we don't question the appearance of the basis to truly exist, because that's how it appears, right? So, and we live by that, we live with that, and it comes from the first time we wake up in the mother's womb, and become conscious of our self and, you know, our situation in the womb. The I. Maybe where am I? It might be our first thought. So this is our job, to then ask the question, if I do exist inherently as I appear to, then I must exist inherently as part of the aggregates or separate from the aggregates. And so we analyse looking for inherently existing I as part of the aggregates or separate from the aggregates. And the third question is, well, if I cannot find an inherent existing I the same or separate, there's no third place for the I to exist. Therefore, it must be a wrong conception. Then where you achieve the path of seeing, or as long as you have come abiding, you're on the way.
So in that process, the aggregates appear, you refute on them,
they appear as inherent existing. Also, within the aggregates is the appearance of an inherent existing person, the person who is functioning and experiencing and creating karma. There's the appearance of person, and then onto that appearance of a person we impute me.
So if there was the appearance of the aggregates, but there was no appearance of the aggregates or apprehension of the aggregates to be inherently existent,
Yeah. Then
you just imputed the actor on Yeah. Top of those aggregates. There was
Yeah. No
apprehension of the inherently existent. Is that just me or not?
Well, sure. I mean, we're talking about a Buddhist mind, because only a Buddha has no appearance of inherent existence. And although there's no appearance of inherent existence in the uninterrupted path of the path of seeing, the mind single-pointedly focused upon emptiness of the self. So there is no appearance of true or inherent existence to that mind. But the mind is just oneness with emptiness. The conventional basis of imputation, the aggregates, have also ceased to appear to that mind. It's just realizing emptiness. So there is also no imputation of mere I, because that is the non-duality of no sense of I am perceiving emptiness. So those are the two examples where there is no appearance of inherent existence. The mind of the meditator, still a sentient being, in a single point of concentration on emptiness, and the Buddhist mind. So now, what Genla said about, or what it came across before lunch, about the Buddha imputes house upon the basis of designation of house, I think that was sort of a general answer to the same question. Yeshichamba Techok said, the Buddhist mind does not impute, because imputing is a function of conceptual mind. And a Buddha does not have conceptual mind. The Buddhist mind at all times is direct awareness. But Yeshichamba Techok said, but the Buddhas know how sentient beings impute house upon that basis of designation. And so the Buddha's mind knows house or maison, or whatever language it is imputed in, the Buddha knows. The Buddha's mind is always in single point of concentration, and simultaneously knowing not just house and the emptiness of house, but knowing every single phenomenon in the universe and its corresponding emptiness. It's very difficult to conceive. Murray's shaking his head. Yeah.
Can you enlarge on the portion that you have?
Sorry?
Can you enlarge on the portion of the eye that does keep
Yeah. What we talk about, we can differentiate the eye or the person into the person of this life and the person who goes from life to life. So the person of this life, we're given a name by our parents, and that name is affixed to this particular body and mind, which change, of course, from baby to teenager, you know, it changes, but it's, the continuity is the same. And so our friends, relatives, everybody can identify the person of this life just by the appearance of this particular body and mind, up until death, when the mind separates from the body. So the person of this life ceases at death, does not continue. Simultaneously, if we analyze how the person is imputed upon this body and mind, then in a more subtle way we see that the person actually exists through mere imputation. The mere imputation is the person, right, upon this body and mind. And it's not the particular name, it is more subtle, just the mere individual, mere I, or the mere person. Now that is still validly continues after death, because at the moment of death, when the person of this life ceases, there's still a continuity. The mind continues in its most subtle state, called clear light, and its associated most subtle form, the most subtle wind, and then it becomes a bit more coarse in the intermediate state, and there's a sense of I, and then that enters the womb of a future mother. So there is a mere I continuing as the intermediate being, and even at the moment of conception, there is still a basis, the continuity of most subtle mind and most subtle wind, which is the basis of imputation of the mere I. And so that carries the karmic imprints and the memories, etc., are all carried on that subtle mind, and they can manifest in the future life. So that merely labelled I, or the mere I, is that which exists now and which exists after death and in the future life. That's what we talk about rebirth. So it's not reincarnation of the person of this life. The person of this life stops because the basis, this particular body, stops. Undefined.
Remnants. The remnants of all the
past that's
still
having
reached Buddhahood have to go through the cycle. That's what you're saying.
Well, the mind bears the echoes, if you like, or the karmic imprints of past actions. It also bears this, like if we were a particularly generous person who had strong quality of generosity, that continues into the next life as well. Or have a strong quality of miserliness, that continues in the next life. All of the mental qualities, good and bad, according to their relative strengths, also are carried into the next life. They're changeable. Of course, no, we're particularly miserly, then conditions in the next life can change and the mind becomes very generous. Bill Gates. When conditions change, we change. So that's what, I guess what you mean, remnants or the echoes?
Well, the lessons we still have to learn, the parts that are still unenlightened,
yep,
have to keep going until they become enlightened, and that's the part that is coming.
Yeah, well, it's not set up to be that way. It's not that we are on a progressive path going towards enlightenment. we're on a circular path. We go from, like even in this life, there are periods when our mind is very clear, perceptive and bright, and other times that our mind is very dull and stupid, and when it gets overwhelmed by selfishness, etc., you know. And so we fluctuate. So this happens from life to life. However, when we do generate understanding leading towards enlightenment, the true path, then those qualities are carried into the next life. They can always be lost by changing conditions until we reach the point of realizing emptiness, or just prior to direct realization of emptiness. It's said that after that point, we will not lose the qualities of enlightenment, and we will indeed progress on a straight line towards nirvana and enlightenment after then. But prior to that, there's danger of losing the good qualities that we've cultivated in the past. Karmic imprints, yeah. Yeah. Well, no, not as opposed to mind. The Prasangikas say that the mere I is that person which goes from life to life and which bears the karmic imprints. No, that's what I asked Amazova many years ago. And Rinpoche's reply was, there is no fault that if the karmic imprints are born on the mental consciousness, there's no fault in saying they're born by the mere I. So that's when Geshe Tenshong said, the mere I exists as a mere name or label that shares the qualities of the basis of labeling, the basis of imputation. The mere I has the same qualities as its basis of imputation.
So at that point there's only one basis.
What?
At the point of where it's at the only.
No, that is the imputation. That's not the basis of imputation. That's the imputation, the mere I.
Yeah,
it's
not
the mind. No, it's based upon the gross five aggregates during life. It's based upon the more and more progressively subtle body and mind during death process, bardo, rebirth. So the point is that, this is a question that I strongly had. How can mere imputation bear karmic imprints? It was the same question I read out here. So it's said very clear in Jeffrey Hopkins and Geshe Sopa, very old book, as you can see. But yeah, this has got the tenets. And anyway, he makes the point. A person is not any of his bases of designation, but the person shares the qualities of all the mental and physical aggregates. So it shares the qualities. So, and that's Rinpoche's answer. There's no fault if the mental consciousness bears the karmic imprints in saying that the mere I bears the karmic imprints. The mere I, no, it's not. It's not this. Well, it depends what you mean by nature, but just qualities. The mere I has the qualities of its basis of designation. Well, if the body crosses the road under the mind's instruction, the mere I crosses the road. If the body gets sick, The mere eye is sick. But it's just a mere imputation. How can it have a virus? Because it's the same as the... It's the same quality. It has the qualities. The Buddha's mere eye... Buddha is merely imputed. Whatever exists is merely imputed. So the mere eye of a Buddha is fully enlightened. It sees all phenomena. It knows all phenomena, conventional and ultimate, simultaneously. But it's merely imputed. How can that be? Because it shares the quality of the Dhammakaya. What was the question?
The answer was something like...
No, what was the question?
Your question is another
question. Yeah. How can you understand the answer if you can't understand the question? If the mere eye is simply an imputation, how can it be the bearer of karmic imprints, as the Prasangikas assert? And Rinpoche's, this was in a car being driven across Taipei, which is a dangerous exercise, I tell you, the way they drive in Taipei. And Rinpoche said, there is no fault if the mental consciousness is the bearer of karmic imprints. There is no fault in saying that the merely imputed eye is a bearer of karmic imprints. Well, I think by just introducing that different term, perceptible object, which is just, it's not what the Tibetans say. They have the same word, direct perceiver, for both the subject and the object. And for us, we're very accustomed to calling a perceiver, it's got to be consciousness, a subjective mind. I coined another term. Anyway, perceptible object. So, I don't feel, I don't know, but I don't feel that there is any hidden agenda in calling the object a direct perceiver. I think it's just a verbal convention, a way of expressing things, that the that in Buddhism they have the tendency to give the name of the cause to the result, like the 10th link of the 12 links is called existence, but existence is the result, it's the cause of existence. So the name of the result is given to the cause. So that's just a thing that they do. So I think that just by calling the object of direct perception a direct perceiver, it's better, as they've done in the text, in our text, to call the object a perceptible object. Who's that guy? So the subjective mind labels cup,
yes,
on the basis of designation of cup.
Yes.
And the, yeah, for the subjective mind, it's a falsity,
yeah,
because it appears as an inherently existing cup.
So when you go and actually look for the object,
yeah,
patterns,
nothing there.
The,
yeah, if you try and find an inherently existing cup, there's nothing there. Yeah, well, you can't even find a relatively existing cup. Well, the Prasangikas say that without analysis, reality can still function. It's like somebody rings up and you make a date to meet at a coffee shop. For both of you, there's no analysis of the person you're going to meet or the I that's going to meet. You just make an appointment, and the appointment happens. You meet the person. So that is valid, that is correct for that particular situation. There's no analysis and things are functioning. They have three ways of presenting things. There's that way, which is just the conventional way we go about life. And then there's the wrong way, when there's strong grasping at the wrong appearance of inherent existence, and that leads to emotional conflict. And then there's a right way of knowing, even intellectually at our level, that the person we're going to meet doesn't inherently exist, and I don't inherently exist. But still, we make the date and we meet at the right time. So these are the three ways. It may come up actually, because this is one of the seven unique Prasangika views, which I hope Genla will talk about.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, even in the text it says, in reality, all concealer or conventional truths are false. But for the ordinary person, we can talk about correct or true and false, or real and unreal conventional truths. And so that is, we do interrelate with each other under the influence of the appearance of inherent existence, which we grasp at as true, but still the interrelationships happen and they correct. So it's real for us because everything we think is inherent existing as it appears. Yeah, it doesn't exist in the way it appears, but for the ordinary person, it's real. But when we go into it, there is no real conventional truth, because all conventional phenomena appear to us to exist inherently. No, it's not a conventional truth. It's an imputation, but it's not only the appearing is inherently existent, but it's appearing as a snake, which is wrong. It's a wrong consciousness. Well, even at a distance, you don't need sunglasses. Yeah, that's a wrong consciousness.
So it's not an example of a wrong
consciousness. No. The subject is wrong. It's a non-existent. That's why all conventional truths are falsities. Sorry? No, I'm saying they're all falsities. They don't exist inherently as they appear. But the appearance of a white snow mountain is blue in the distance is a wrong consciousness because of the appearance of blue, which is it's more gross than the subtle mistake of grasping at inherent existence. An inherently existing Andy is an example of a false conventional truth.
The one again, the mirror. If everything is off in the mirror, you have to say, oh, that's Andy in the mirror. It's not the mirror.
In
the text, it's using different words, so rather than using true or false, if you look at the top of page 27, the text says, talk about truly established forms. So there's no argument, so quite clearly that the my face and the face in the mirror are neither of them truly established forms. And they use the words real and unreal to distinguish between a conventional truth that is appears to exist and has a basis for that, and one that appears to exist and doesn't have a basis.
Okay, so they're both conventional truths, but one is real and one is not real.
That's what using the words in the text.
Let's go back to say the snake is right. The snake is also conventional truth, it's not real.
Not real, yeah.
In that definition that was given before, that topic, that
well, no, I mean, according to the Prasangikas, there is all conventional truths are false.
Yeah, but
and there's no. Now, for ordinary people, for ordinary people, so something which is false is a lake where there's a mirage. Like the mirage is real, but the lake is unreal. For ordinary people. Yeah, the mirage exists and it appears as water, but the label water is, or lake, is mistaken. All right, time for an inherently existing cup of tea.
Thank you.